Welcome to Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series of the same title. The talks will be done in a more informal style, so you may wish to consult the printed texts, which are made available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. I hope you enjoy the talks. Thank you. Touch and feeling are our most reliable and perhaps our most primitive measures of reality. Yet we all know that they aren't necessarily reliable. If I put my finger in a flame, I feel the heat of it, the risk to my flesh, and I have not a single doubt in the world of the reality of the flame. When someone asks us a question, even in the most intellectually controlled situation, the initiation of our response comes from our feelings about the question. Feeling, emotion, and touch are complexly interrelated in ways we will continue to explore. As Charles Sanders Peirce showed, hypothetic inference is fueled by a feeling kind of knowing. Yet a single word may trigger us to feel insulted or abandoned. Common experience reveals that these feelings are often not connected to external reality. Feeling bridges physical and emotional sensation, yet both are powerfully resident in our bodies. We know that we often feel emotionally in ways not supported by the world around us. Still, the depth of these feelings and their power to impact us is undeniable. V.S. Ramachandran studied many cases of feelings not supported by reality in the fascinating cases of phantom limbs. There is a high incidence among amputees of continuing to feel the limb or body part that has been removed. Interestingly, I've been running into phantom limb syndrome references frequently in the last few days. Herman Melville, in his writing of Moby Dick, refers to phantom limb related to Ahab, whose limb was eaten by the big whale. Walt Whitman served as a helper to people recovering in the Civil War and experienced hundreds of people that had amputations, and he makes reference to phantom limb syndrome. And then I just finished reading Stephen King's book, Duma Key, in which the entire novel is set on sort of mysterious operations that turn out to be an art form that his protagonist, who has lost a limb, has. Anyway, it's an amazing thing that this shows up so much. Sometimes this phantom limb situation is a bizarre situation of an amputee feeling that he or she can extend the arm and operate fingers to do such tasks as pick up a cup of coffee. Other times it manifests in intense pain in the non-existent limb. Sometimes the feeling is of a limb, but one completely immobile. Physicians and researchers have been mostly mystified by this phenomenon. Ramachandran has made significant progress in both understanding and treating phantom limb syndrome, and in doing so, he has also revealed much about the workings of the brain in relation to the larger body. There are a number of provocative issues associated with phantom limb studies that are valuable for us to consider with respect to our seemingly distant interests in the study of religions and cultures. First, how do we grasp the complexity of the brain? Ramachandran put it this way. I'm quoting him extensively here. He wrote, "A piece of your brain the size of a grain of sand would contain 100,000 neurons, 2 million axons, and 1 billion synapses all talking to each other. Given these figures, it's been calculated that the number of possible brain states, the number of permutations and combinations of activity that are theoretically possible, exceeds the number of elementary particles in the universe." How can one grasp such utter complexity presented by the brain? Brain scientists are not kidding when they tell us that they know next to nothing about the brain. A couple of weeks ago, I was visiting with Pat Guyton, a master Pilates teacher. She told me that standing at rest, simply raising one's arm to the side, engages an astounding number of required responses from proprioceptors and muscles distributed across the body to simply keep us from falling over from the levered weight of the extended arm. Add this kind of complexity to that of the brain, since the brain and body are inseparable, and the results are just overwhelming. I suppose the downside of trying to grasp all this complexity is that we have no hope whatsoever of actually understanding a significant amount of the physical bodied aspects of being human. When we appreciate that we are bodies, even as we are minds and spirits, the sheer order of complexity may seem so great as to shut us down. However, should we want to hold out any hope for retaining awe, mystery, wonder, what could possibly rival the appreciation of the complexity of brain, body, mind, spirit? Clearly, our fears should be relieved that to consider religion and culture from the perspective of the body is somehow reducing them to the merely mechanical, physical, and chemical. Indeed, it is to the very order of complexity that we find the basis for our freedom, for our individuality. I am interested in the mapping aspect of Ramachandran's phantom limb studies. He, as have many before him, shows that the human body is mapped on the brain. He says that the entire body surface is mapped on the brain, and that there are many maps in the brain corresponding to body and bodily functions. 30 maps are known to be associated with vision alone. Since mapping is one of the principal metaphors that the study of religions and cultures use to help us understand what we are doing, I want to reflect on what neuroscientists mean by maps. By maps, they indicate that there is a physical representation in the brain of the terrain of the body. Yet in this instance of mapping, the relationship between the brain map and the body part is an actual neurological connection. Here, stimulating an area of the brain map will result in a felt sensation or physical action in the corresponding body part, and vice versa. We can certainly appreciate why the brain areas corresponding to body areas are called maps. There is a one-to-one relationship between the two, and the physical area taken in the brain is a tiny fraction of the physical area of the body's surface. Thus, there is a scale in the relationship between the map and the territory. However, unlike conventional maps, these brain areas corresponding with body features are neurologically connected. I think in this instance it would be better to adjust our understanding of the body and the brain to understand them as inseparable. The body surface is surely nothing but meat without the interconnection to the brain, and the brain area is useless without connection to the body. The skin is the outer surface of the brain. The body is the extension of the brain. This mapping is, or at least in one sense, but only one sense, hardwired, genetic, generic to being human, and generic to simply having a brain. Should we use this type of mapping as metaphorically reflecting some aspects of the study of religions and cultures, we would understand more fully the relationship between scholar and subject. As scholars, particularly seeing ourselves as generally removed from society, the distance symbolized by the idyllic campuses on which we dwell, we seem to care not about our relationship to our subject. Only rarely would we think of ourselves as actually interconnected with them. We may occasionally encounter them in the field. We may occasionally invite one of them to come into our space. Yet we do not consider our mapping as anything beyond marks on pieces of paper. A large amount of the research I have done on the study of religions and cultures has documented the actual and physical impact scholars have on their subjects. My book, Story Tracking, included a consideration of two of our most important influential religion scholars, Mircea Eliade and Jonathan Smith, both teachers of mine, to show how both of them constructed the subjects they used to document their understandings of religion, and in doing so, their subjects, actual people and cultures, have undergone significant change. The cases I have worked on are not isolated and unusual examples. Timothy Mitchell's book, Colonizing Egypt, shows how 19th century European exhibits representing the city Cairo resulted eventually in physical changes in the city itself so that it would conform to European expectations. I could provide many other examples. Certainly, the academy is a colonial enterprise, and we surely must know that we have changed the world as we have studied it. We insist that the world we observe conform to the expectations we have of it. Our study of something invariably transforms it in itself to correspond with our expectations projected on it. The point here is that we need to think of ourselves as connected to our subjects in the same way as our bodies are connected to our brain maps. That is, they are connected and interdependent. Such a perspective demands that we be more sensitive and responsible scholars, and more powerful as well. Another mapping that Ramachandran discusses is the sort involved in human perception. Ramachandran discusses this mapping in the context of his phantom limb studies. While the limb is physically gone, the brain creates and holds a map of the missing limb, often interwoven with other body areas, reflecting powerful sensations like pain attributed to the missing limb. The absence of the interconnection between brain map area and a corresponding body area is not known to the area of the brain that maps the missing part. Ramachandran uses a mirror illusion to give visual feedback to the brain. I'll consider the relationship between vision and touch shortly and in later lectures. The most important principle underlying all perception, according to the Ramachandran's research, is that the mechanisms of perception are mainly involved in extracting statistical correlations from the world to create a model that is temporarily useful. The sort of mapping that is involved with perception is more like our traditional understanding of mapping in that the map and territory are related but separate. The brain has a symbolic representation of the external world. Perception is fundamentally an interpretive and representative enterprise, not one that objectively records the external reality, nor is it a one-way process, that is, from external to internal, but rather an interactive, oscillatory process, a comparative process, if you will. Perception is a process of creating symbolic images and patterns that our brains use to operate all of the functions of the body-mind. The process is creative in that it, like the interpreter function of the left brain, seeks whole pictures, meaningful relationships, congruency, and sensibility. Ramachandran includes a number of visual exercises with diagrams he includes to demonstrate how vision fills in and alters patterns. His exercises demonstrate how our visual blind spot is filled in effect assuring gapless coherence of reality. Filling in, providing the missing pieces, is the way perception works. We have images of our bodies and the world that guide our perception and help fill in gaps in the raw data that we collect to conform to these images. Yet our perceptions also serve to reinforce, as well as modify, and even radically change these images. In this understanding, Ramachandran believes that nature is not opposed to nurture, but rather, as was demonstrated in the many studies of color, there is a complex interaction between them. These ideas are powerfully captured in his statement, I'm quoting him, "Your own body is a phantom, one that your brain has temporarily constructed purely for convenience." To apply this information to our work, the stream of readings we are doing is hammering home the position that human beings are story makers and storytellers. Our bodies, including our brains, are designed to fill in gaps, to make up stories, to reshape raw perceptual information, to confirm resident images and schemas, to use held images and schemas to shape our perceptions, to engage in imaginative, playful, oscillatory creative processes. Michael Gazzaniga showed this human quality in terms of brain hemispheric actions. Mark Johnson demonstrated this with the sensory motor patterns and schemas that inform basic level categories and the very idea of categorization. And now Ramachandran shows that in some senses, our bodies are phantoms, fabrications of our brains. Our perceptual processes fill in gaps, shift lines, construct images based on unconscious best guesses. We must surely be impacted by this overwhelming realization that we are prone to creating fictions and we do not even know we are doing it. We may choose to be horrified by this information or to celebrate it, but we most certainly should not ignore it. As students of religion and culture, we must not only recognize these processes in ourselves, but also in our subjects. We create ourselves and one another as we discover one another in ourselves. Another aspect of Ramachandran's work that fascinates me is its implications for touch. I'm a big fan of touch as the foundational sense. Touch is a remarkably complex sense that involves sensation on the skin, the surface, or outside, while at the same time touch or feeling occurs on the inside from the flesh below the skin. And there is also proprioceptive touch, which is how the body knows where it is in space, that is, the internal touch of the body by the body itself. How appropriate it is that touch is inseparable from feeling and emotion. Touch and feeling are, as I noted at the outset, a ground of our bodily being and the unquestioned measure of reality. Touch and vision are interconnected. We'll study this later as we consider Maurice Merleau-Ponty. Ramachandran demonstrates the connection by his mirror trickery used with amputees, where vision provides them a feedback loop to help revise brain mappings of the missing body parts. Touching is also the sense most associated with sensory motor actions, that is, with self-directed and experienced bodily movement. Touch invariably invokes a sense of movement. Were we to carefully contemplate the importance of touch to being human, we would surely revise in significant ways our approach to the study of religions and cultures. The sensory motor patterns, the basic level categories set by repetition throughout the long history of our academic studies of religion, exclude almost totally any of the implications of touch, even its interdependence on vision. Ramachandran shows, through a fascinating exercise, that we may appear to feel in our bodies something touching a table. The ease with which we are capable of incorporating in a feeling way, in an experiential way, non-fleshy things into our bodies is quite remarkable. Ramachandran's demonstrations that we can feel stimulations to a plastic hand or even a tabletop, obviously and visually confirmed as inanimate and artificial, is most amazing. It is a matter of course to embrace the idea that we may transcend the boundaries of our skin by touch, but we don't generally think that we can have feeling sensations from external and artificial objects in the same way we feel with our bodied sense of touch. Again, this ability to appropriate objects into our bodies is possible primarily through the sense of touch, conditioned by even a remarkably brief period of sensory motor patterning. Such insights take us back to the classic theories of magic presented by E.B. Tyler in the late 19th century. It opens many interesting possibilities for expanding our studies. It increases the sense of importance of repetitive patterned movement forms such as ritual and dancing. It increases the sense of importance of our relationship to objects and material culture. The objects and structures we surround ourselves with are extensions of ourselves, and we come to actually think of the external world through the incorporation of these objects into our bodies. Think of our clothing, our transportation vehicles, our houses, our cities, our countries. Through routinized sensory motor conditioning, we feel in our bodies through these inanimate, non-sentient, and completely constructed things. Thank you for listening to this volume of Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series by the same title. I am making this lecture series in print form available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. Thank you very much for listening to this volume, and I'll be talking to you again later. Bye-bye.